Welcome to Marfa Mondays with your host, award-winning travel writer and novelist, C.M. Mayo.
Welcome to the fourth in this series of 24 podcasts exploring Marfa, Texas, and environs as part of my larger project, which is writing a travel memoir about West Texas. I still haven't come up with the book's title, although I have a few promising candidates. I'm recording this introduction in April of 2012, so if you're listening in sometime later, it's quite possible that my book not only has a title, but has been written and published. So I invite you to visit my website, www.cmmayo.com, and read all about it. You can also read about this podcast series and Marfa, Texas at www.cmmayo.com/Marfa. As I explained in the previous two podcasts in February 2012 and March 2012, my initial travels in the area have focused on the landscape, this breathtaking space, because I aim to begin the book by following the path, as far as we can guess it, of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, the conquistador who got lost. Imagine the land without highways, without fences, telephone lines, cell phone towers, gas stations. When it comes to landscapes, painters are important people to talk to. Like all artists, they make a practice of seeing what others do not. In the previous podcast, which was posted in March of 2012, although recorded in January, I interviewed Mary Bones, the curator of a beautiful exhibition of Texas regionalist paintings at Sol Ross University in Alpine, which is, by the way, about a half hour's drive from Marfa. That exhibition was The Lost Colony, featuring works by artists who participated in the summer colony at Sol Ross that ended, somewhat mysteriously, in 1950. The show included paintings by Julius Waltz, Javier Gonzalez, William Lester, and Mabel Vandiver, among many others. In the 1970s, the sculptor and painter Donald Judd arrived in Marfa and began buying up buildings in the town and ranches in the area. Judd was such a prolific, accomplished, and profoundly visionary artist that ever since, artists in the area have worked in his immense shadow. It's impossible, indeed, to find any writing about the arts in the area that doesn't at least mention Judd and his works and the two foundations, the Judd Foundation and Chinati Foundation, the latter a museum based on Judd's vision for large-scale installations in which, to quote from their website, art and the surrounding landscape are inextricably linked. I'm sure I'll have a lot to say about Judd and his legacy, but for now I'm getting started with the landscape per se. So I wanted to talk to someone who paints landscapes. Avram Dumitrescu's paintings were featured recently in Marfan's Art from the Plateau at the Nancy Fife Cardozier Gallery in Odessa. For his extraordinary talent and his connections with Sol Ross University, I think it would be fair to say he is a direct descendant of those artists of the so-called Lost Colony. Though some of those artists were originally from Texas, many came from afar. For example, Javier Gonzalez, who was born in Spain and studied art in Mexico City. Avram Dumitrescu grew up in Belfast, Northern Ireland. He has a fascinating story. Be sure to check out his paintings of landscapes, as well as animals, birds, automobiles, and more, on his website, www.onlineavram.com. So, we're here on a chilly, bright day in Alpine, Texas, in the Big Bend Arts Council's Gallery on the Square with Avram Dumitrescu. I encountered Avram's work in Sinizo Journal, and I'm always talking about Sinizo Journal because it's just such a beautiful, elegant contribution to this whole area. I'm very impressed by this, and they had a whole piece about your watercolors. And so then I went to your website and found some really amazing landscape paintings and illustrations. Your website says that you grew up in Belfast, yes, in Ireland, and your father was from Romania, and you met your wife in Texas and moved out here. So, wow, that's exotic. Maybe we should start with, how did you meet your wife, who, by the way, is Megan Wilde, who I've seen her writing also, which is on the net. She's a wonderful writer who has a lot of pieces about the Big Bend area.
Well, it's interesting to just, I realized, you know, two artists. Well, I'm an artist and Megan's a journalist, so that means we're both destined for the poor house. Let's see, I'd worked at a summer camp in Belfast. I'd done 1 year, but really enjoyed it. And I think I was 17 or 18 at the time. And a friend, I can't remember whom, had suggested, they said, oh, you should try doing it in America. And so I applied and got accepted. And this is a pretty convoluted story, but I worked at a summer camp up in Maine, Skylamar Summer Camp. It was a lot of fun. I'd fly out for 7 to 8 weeks. And I'd be teaching, working with a high school art teacher there, and be teaching the children just fun art projects. Because it was mostly a sports summer camp, but the art was kind of like a reprieve for some of them. And I really enjoyed it. I also did the big sets. The summer camp would put musicals on each year. So basically, they were just giant illustrations. But that was a lot of fun. So I did this for about, I think, 5 or 6 years, maybe 6 years. And afterwards, I'd usually travel around with a couple of friends. And 1 year, one of the friends I was traveling with, or I wanted to meet, happened to be down in Florida. So I made my way down there and met this blonde lady who was very interested in, but didn't really make it that apparent because I'm not particularly good at that kind of thing. So I kept in touch with Megan, and the following summer when I did my last summer camp, I met up with her again. We started dating, and we dated transatlantically for, gosh, about 3 years. So I just started a master's in applied arts, and that meant I was able to save my money. I took my vacation, would fly out, and just one day decided, you know, we should just get married. And we did, and it was very good. So I left Belfast, and I've been here since the end of 2004. So it's very different from Belfast. The skies are a little more blue out here. It doesn't rain quite as much.
That's an understatement. I think of Belfast as being very wet.
Yes. Well, it is pretty damp, but what's also interesting is when you just look at the grass there, it's just this verdant, verdant green, you know, because there's so much rain. So yeah, lots of rain, and as well because, you know, Belfast's quite a built-up city, so moving from Belfast out to West Texas was quite a contrast, you know, it's...
Well, what prompted you to move out here to Alpine?
Well, when we got married, we were living in Austin, and Megan had interned at the Chinati Foundation, I think it was back in the late 90s, and she really...
In Marfa.
So after she worked out there, she really liked, she just had a real affinity for the place. So we moved out, gosh, I think it was a couple of years later, and at first I was a little intimidated. I thought, it's going to be really tough because Austin, you know, had good coffee shops, it had all kinds of box stores, movie theaters, grocery stores, and moving out to West Texas, it was a little less populated, and I thought, how am I going to get a good cup of coffee? But we survived, and it was actually one of the best things we did because it was such a small community, you got to know everybody pretty quickly, and just in terms of art, my work started selling much more quickly, and I was able to develop more as an artist because I had more time to just focus on things that I wouldn't normally focus on in Austin. I think in Austin I was doing some architecture paintings and some vehicles, and out here I discovered animals, and they've proved pretty popular.
Your chicken paintings. I love the chicken paintings. I am really crazy about them because they have such... There's one that was in... it's on your website, okay. Nibs.
Okay.
That painting, which is sold, alas, that painting, that is the biggest personality of any chicken I have ever seen. No, I they're really extraordinary animal paintings.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to remember. It was... There was a similar magazine to the Cinezo called The Desert Candle, and I knew the owner and editor, and she'd suggested, she said, I'd like you to do a cover. I think the theme she gave me was summer, and so I'd played with some ideas, and then a friend of ours in Marfa, Taggy Lancaster, has several donkeys, so I photographed them and did a nice stormy... because you do get a lot of storms out here, landscape. And that became the cover and was apparently really popular. So that kind of started me. I was working on animals and, donkeys and horses. And when we moved to Alpine, our landlords had about 30 chickens. Patty and Cindy, they're on the west edge of town. And great people, really, really nice people. But that's where I... had my first experience being around chickens, because until then it was just stuff I'd eat. And they're basically mini dinosaurs. Every time I go in, I'm always worried if I fall and they start pecking me to death, like some horror movie, because they if they see red, they run to it and attack it. But I'm kind of getting a little off topic here. They're very interesting characters. And I think what really made me laugh was Patty and Cindy had named them after characters from The Sopranos. So kind of with their sometimes thuggish nature, especially some of the roosters, they were apt names. So
it comes through in the paintings.
Yeah, they're fun to paint.
Well, you've painted a really broad variety of things. I mean, starting out with the car paintings mm-hmm. that you did in your master's degree in Belfast. Yeah. I learned that from reading your website. Okay. But when I look at what you've done here in West Texas, you've done all sorts of things, and your landscape paintings are also extraordinary. So I'm curious to know, who have been some of your biggest influences as an artist?
Well, let me try to answer that a different way. I mean, the reason there's a lot of variety is boredom. If I spend too much time doing one thing, I'll get tired of it, and it will show in the artwork. For every successful painting I've made, there's maybe 5 canvases which get painted over, at least. And then I find sketching's a great way to kind of work out ideas, and it's a real thrilling thing. It's one of the best things I can do, besides eating desserts. But influences, historically, I've always found the artist John Singer Sargent he was a master of painting. I mean, when you just see how he handled light, he had this way of putting paint onto the canvas which was incredibly loose, but every shape and pushing of the paint had some meaning, and it was just... But locally, 2 people I always find a lot of influence from are, one of them is, there's a photographer who's sadly not doing much photography in Marfa now called Chase Lindley. His wife works at the Marfa public radio station. He's just such a talented photographer. And then Mary Baxter, her landscapes and animals are a big, big influence on me.
I have to tell you, I own 2 of her paintings. I just love them. One is the Santa Elena Canyon, and the other one of Cathedral Mountain.
Oh, those are very good acquisitions. We were really lucky when we had a baby shower. That was one of the gifts that Mary gave us, and it's very treasured. But yeah, she's a big influence on me, just how she handles landscape especially. That's something I want to do more of, and I just haven't really had the opportunity.
Well, you have a new baby.
Yes.
That'll keep anyone from going out and working. but aside from that, this area strikes me as incredibly painterly. I just went over to the Lost Colony show. And now this is a podcast, so by the time y'all are listening to this, the show will have closed. But I think that the slideshow should be available on the Sol Ross website. But I was really struck by that. And one of the first things I saw when I walked in was this big quote they had up on the wall by one of the students of the art colony who said, "The Big Bend is the most paintable place I have ever worked." And that was a student named Mrs. Ruth Lovelady from 1940.
Mary Bones did such a good job putting that exhibition together. I know she had to contact collectors all around the states. It's such an impressive show, and I really hope your listeners can get to see the slideshow of it. I really hope that in the future Ross will be able to do something like that again, because just to have these intensive weeks and months where students would work with an artist and produce all this wonderful work, it's a shame that it hasn't happened, but you know, things change, so but hopefully in the future they'll do something like that.
Well, as a veteran of many summer writing colonies or summer writing workshops, I have to say this area has two enormous advantages, I think. And one is that it is incredibly easy and inviting and enticing. I'm not a painter, but I mean, I would love to go out and paint these landscapes. They're just breathtaking. I was driving back yesterday from Fort Davis here to Alpine at sunset, and to just watch the sun go down over those mountains, it's just so beautiful. Sometimes you just want to cry. It's just, it's like an otherworldly landscape.
There's spectacular light out here on the landscape. I think as well, the landscape is probably more apparent because, you know, there's very few billboards.
Almost none. In fact, and now that you mention it, that when I was driving back on that section, that you just don't see anything. I mean, you look at this huge landscape, the entire horizon, you don't even see a tower. Now, there are some towers out there, but you can go long stretches without seeing anything but nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's a big reason why it's so impressive. But yeah, the light as well, it's a very different light. When we were... Megan delivered our baby up in Dallas, and it was really interesting just how different the light was. You know, it's 500 miles away, but I don't know if it was the elevation or the air quality, but it's a unique place. I don't know how many places in America are like this, in that there's not much advertising, there's not many signposts, it's not many buildings, so it adds to its appeal.
There have been artists coming here in, let's say, the Western tradition, because I don't want to forget, well, of course, we have rock art in the Big Bend, which is a very different tradition with a different group of people. But there have been artists coming here for a very long time, few and far between, but they have been coming. And Mary Bones' show, The Lost Colony, is really the first major statement about, well, there really was something here. And so now when I'm looking at this area, of course, the first thing I heard of was Marfa, because of Donald Judd and the foundations, the Chinati Foundation and the Judd Foundation and the various galleries in Marfa. But of course, there are galleries here in Alpine. There are several galleries here in Alpine, and there are a lot of artists in this region who may not necessarily be in one town or the other. They're just kind of living out somewhere with goats and chickens and horses and I don't know what, but they're here, and they kind of, over this large area, form a kind of community. So when you came here, how did you find that community? How would you describe that community of artists here?
Spread out. That's probably the way. And let's see, my...
Well, I think we have to include Mary Baxter, too, and she's out in Marathon.
Absolutely.
Which is 30 miles out east.
Yeah, I think Mary's lived in Marfa. I mean, my experiences were when we moved out here, we happened to try to find accommodation when the two big movies were shooting, There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men. And so there was virtually no accommodation. We found something at Fort Davis. We had planned to live in Marfa because Megan was going to intern at the radio station, the Marfa Public Radio Station. We lived in Fort Davis for about 6 months, and that gave me the chance to... While Megan was working at the radio station, that gave me the chance to work on... I would just draw and paint as much as I could. And I think during that time, I'd contacted several of the galleries in just all over. And there was a gallery which is sadly not here anymore. It was the Reine Canada Gallery. And I think Charlie Bell now has that. But I was offered a show there, so I put it together. And it was a big success. I remember the Marianne Madison was... She said, oh, it was really wonderful. It was such a... good turnout. So that was encouraging. I think that was, to me as well, that was the first time it was like, oh, my first major show over here, and people actually like the crazy stuff I do. Well, I wouldn't say crazy, but...
Well, those chickens are crazy. The mafioso chickens.
I'd say Marfa's probably the... When people think of art, that Marfa is... what people think of first, just because, yeah, like you've said, Donald, Judd and Chinati, you know, they've been there since, what, the 70s? And then with Judd being such an important person in the minimalist movement, it has that mystique and international appeal. I mean, I remember when we finally did live in Marfa for about a year, there would be a lot of German tourists and people from all over the world coming to see this unique... style. And then what's also interesting about Marfa is, especially the main streets, there's a particular look. You know, the minimalism's kind of spread out into the architecture, and so you do have some galleries, you have art that mimics, that's kind of minimalist, but you know, when it bleeds into the other areas of life, it makes it a very interesting, unique town. I think Alpine recently received an arts designation from the state of Texas. I'm not sure exactly of the wording, but that helped. And then there were several galleries. I actually had a studio just around the corner from here. It was a studio gallery, but I closed it just when Megan got pregnant. And what's nice is in this main street now, there's about 3 galleries altogether, and the majority of them... Well, no, there's 4. There's a photographer that's moved to here. So it's kind of... It needs to be concentrated. When it's spread out a little too much, it may not feel as much of an arts community, whereas when it's, like, on one street, then it starts to get that particular vibe.
Oh, definitely. And then people, when they come through, they can hit all the galleries.
Yes.
And they can see them. They're visible.
Yes.
Yeah, so there's definitely a synergy.
Yeah. So they, I mean, it is nice in my lunchtime. If it's raining and I can't cycle at lunchtime, I'll walk down to see what's going on in the local galleries. Personally, again, I find it a very supportive community. I think the fact that because it's small, people know what you do. You will get asked to donate paintings to things like the library board or to help raise money for the library or for the animal shelters. And that's, you know, it's a good way to get your name out and just help people as well. So it's a small community, people know you, and I think that all helps. Because I find that a lot of art has a touch of fashion about it. You know, you kind of have to build up the momentum. People need to know your name, and that does help sell your work. Mm-hmm. So these are kind of half-baked thoughts on a Saturday morning. I don't know how much validity there is to them, but...
One of the first things anybody notices about you is your name, Dumitrescu, which is Romanian.
My father, he escaped from Romania when it was a communist country in the early 1970s. My mother, she grew up in Belfast, and she came from a big family. She has 12 brothers and sisters, and her mother said, like, go travel, go see the world. So she went to... I think she started off at Germany. she wanted to travel with some friends and her sister, some of her sisters. So they got to Germany, and the jobs that they were interested in weren't there because of some big strikes. So they went to the Channel Islands, and they found work there. And I think they were young. They wanted to see some of the world, you know, grow up. Especially the 1970s in Belfast was not a... there was a lot of political trouble.
It was really a tough time.
Yeah, so I think that was probably one reason my mother wanted to see some of the world, you know, just have a change of tone. So my father, he played a lot of musical instruments, and he was in a Romanian folk band, and they travelled all around Europe, but I think there were maybe 15, 16 band members, and around half of them were secret police.
Oh my goodness, making sure the other half didn't escape.
That was it. So my father did, on one of the tours, he managed to sneak away when everybody was sleeping. And he'd been talking to a restaurant owner, and the restaurant owner had said, look, if you can get to the airport, I'll fly you to the other island, and let you get away from all this. So he didn't have much English, or I think he had very little English, and ran onto the road and tried to find a vehicle, and all he saw, it was like 4 or 5 in the morning, it was one of those electric milk floats, you know, their top speed's like maybe 10 miles an hour. So he finally saw this big truck going down the road and was able to explain to the guy by making these airplane sounds that he was trying to get to the airport. So got to the airport and didn't see the restaurant owner that was promising to look after him. And he saw a policeman walking up and down. And his thought was, I'll go up to the policeman and punch him. And then they'll arrest me and then I can claim political asylum. But thankfully, the restaurant owner turned up and so brought him to the other place. And eventually, I think they called Interpol and said, oh, we're glad you weren't missing. And he was able to get UK citizenship. So well, my father was... I think the gentleman owned several restaurants and my mother happened to be working at one of them. So my father and mother started talking and really liked each other and eventually got married. And they moved back to Belfast and I was born in 76. So it's a... There's a longer version of that story, but it...
It's an amazing story.
Well, thank you. I just didn't want to use up all your podcast time on that, so...
But it's really an extraordinary story.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it kind of contrasts with me where I just had to... I was working with children and met somebody through traveling and, you know, was very pleased to meet my wife and I'm glad I didn't have to be running from secret police or anything.
Well, we can so often forget what a privilege, what a luxury it is to have the freedom to make art or to write or to go where you please, when you please, to say what you want to say.
That's a key thing, and that's something that kind of will bubble up in my mind so many times. It's like, especially if I'm, say, having difficulty with the painting or something, it's like, well, you have a roof over your head, you can eat, you have a wife that loves you, you have a baby who's wonderful, you know, people don't have electricity, people have all kinds of problems in their life, and I'm glad when I remember to be grateful about all the blessings I have in my life.
Oh, I think we all have to take a lesson from that and say the same. Oh, what a story. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, let me ask you a couple last questions here. Your favorite subjects for painting?
Whatever interests me at the time. I've been painting animals for quite a while. Architecture is always interesting. Vehicles can be interesting. I think things that look weathered and have a little more personality as well. I want to do more landscapes. I really need to get back into painting figures.
What do you think you'll be painting next? I mean, if you look over the course of this year, 2012, what do you see on the horizon for yourself?
When I'm not cleaning up diapers, We were in Galveston, I think, last summer, visiting family, and had a camera with me, and I was photographing the seagulls. So I've actually got two big canvases. They're ready to be painted of seagulls. And I've done one, and I've been trying to loosen up a little. I also had a commission. There's a lady in town who asked me to paint her. It's a real estate building, and I was watching it for the last couple of months, and the sun never seemed to light up the front of it. And for me, an important thing with my artwork is it needs to have good light and shadows, and it never seemed to light up. So I said to her, look, would you mind leaving the lights on one evening? And she did, and so I've sketched it out, and it's this nice kind of electric blue sky with this kind of orange tealy light coming out of it. So afterwards I thought, well, I've wanted to try structures at night, so I then spent a couple of hours photographing gas stations and, gosh, what else? It was things that, when I was working on the photographs, it almost had an Edward Hopper quality. That's what I was trying to find. Just
so stark with shadows.
Yeah, because you'd get these kind of, like one of the gas stations, it would just, the light would leak off. It would taper to a point, and then it was just all this blackness. Mm. And I thought, well, this could be an interesting direction. So there was that. Alpine's also had a lot of construction going on the last year. So at my lunchtime, I'd go out and sketch the construction vehicles. So that might be a series of small pieces. So night buildings, construction vehicles, and God knows what else.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
That sounds very interesting. And that's definitely different than the animal paintings. But it's kind of coming back to what you did earlier about cars. You started out with a show with cars. I wanted to jump in and ask you, you're also working as a scientific illustrator for the Center for Big Ben Studies. So what do you do there?
I work for a team of archaeologists. It's part of Sulros State University. And it's all manner of visual arts. It's a very interesting job. The more basic stuff is I'll update their website, I'll do graphic design, I'll do posters and so on for them. But every now and again they'll bring me in a point, but an arrowhead that's thousands of years old. So it's really interesting. I'm holding these small pieces of stone and drawing them. It's demanding, it's really, really tough, but, it's something I never thought I'd be doing. And then I've been teaching part-time at Sulros State University. I've been teaching some design classes, so that's a really, really satisfying and fulfilling job. I think that's what I had to tell myself as well when I'd done a full-time, I'd go in, I'd start at 8 o'clock, and finish at 5, I'd eat, and then teach from 6 to 9. So I kept having to tell myself, even though your eyes are going together, you really are enjoying this. But, I mean, it was really, it's very interesting, and it's very rewarding teaching the students. You know, I think I've done a lot of illustration work and fine art work, and it's nice to work with some students, especially a student who may not have gone to college before and just sit down and just say, well, look, I'm not the best artist in the world. I don't have lots of experience, but this is what you may encounter if you follow this path. So it's been really nice sharing my experiences with just local people.
This was a fantastic interview.
Well, thank
you. I thank you so much for giving me your time.
Tune in for Marfa Mondays with your host, CM Mayo, at cmmayo.com/podcasts.
Baja, California is a place where nothing is as it seems. Cleaved from the Mexican mainland by the Sea of Cortez and separated from the rest of North America by a multitude of cultural and economic differences, the nearly 1,000-mile-long peninsula is scarred by imperial transgressions, yet blessed with extraordinary natural beauty. The very air here is miraculous, wrote John Steinbeck, and outlines of reality change with the moment. It was desire that first took C.M. Mayo to Baja California, but only a longing for understanding could produce this exquisite portrait of the other Mexico. Intimate, perceptive, and incomparably rich, C.M. Mayo's miraculous air will delight readers who already know and love Baja California and provide a memorable introduction for those who know it primarily as a distant source of allure. Available now in paperback from Milkweed Editions and ebook from Dancing Chiva. Traveler's Literary Companion. The Los Angeles Times Book Review calls it a book to throw in a suitcase on the way to Mexico or just settling into a favorite patio chair. It will open your eyes and fill you with pleasure. Mexico Connect says, discovering it was like opening a door and walking into a brightly lit room filled with all kinds of literary treasures. Mexico, a Traveler's Literary Companion, 24 Mexican Writers on Mexico, selected by award-winning writer and translator C.M. Mayo, is available from Whereabouts Press. Look for it in bookstores and all major online booksellers. Hear a country speak. Find out more about Mexico, a Traveler's Literary Companion, at cmmayo.com.